WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Detective writer Walter Mosley has some pretty impressive fans. He's one of President Clinton's favorite writers. Film director Jonathan Demme is bringing Mosley's first detective novel to the screen. The hero of Mosley's novels is E.Z. Rawlins, a black private detective from the Watts area of L.A. The first novel, Devil in a Blue Dress, takes place just after World War II. Each subsequent novel finds E.Z. Rawlins a few years older and living in a new political and social era. The new novel, Black Betty, is set in the early 60s. President Kennedy and Martin Luther King are giving E.Z. a sense of hope, but things are pretty grim at home. His wife has left him and taken his only birth child. Money's running out, and it's hard to feed his two adopted kids. To make ends meet, he's taken on a case to find a woman who's disappeared. The book opens with a recurring nightmare about the night E.Z. witnessed his best friend Mouse commit a murder. Mouse gets into trouble in each of Mosley's mysteries.
I see Mouse as the hero of the world that E.Z. is talking about. He's a sociopath. He's very violent. He's willing to kill people, and it doesn't affect him. E.Z. is the hero of these books because these books are about him. But the world he lives in, Mouse is really the hero, the man who's willing to stand up and fight and not be pushed down for any reason, not for a political motive, just because he's crazy. He's been driven crazy by the world he lives in.
Would you read the dream for us? And this is a dream of something that really happened.
Yeah, at least really happened in the book.
Right. Really happened in the book.
They were standing under a hard yellow light in the alley behind John's bar. Big Hand Bruno Ingram was large and powerful, and he had the ability to swagger even when he was standing still. He wore a brown mohair suit with no hat and no shirt. The smaller man's suit was close-fitting and silver, imported, I knew, from Italy. I stayed in the shelter of the doorway listening to their small talk, hidden. "I just lost it," Mouse, the smaller man, was saying. He sounded fine. "You owe me 25 cents. "Come on, Sookie," a bodiless voice said from the street. It was a man's voice, a young man. "Uh-uh, Alfred," a woman answered as clear as you could want, but I didn't hear the rest of what she said. Bruno's bass voice was rumbling, "Get out of my face." I turned again, a sense of dread so deep in my body that it felt like the oldest thing in the world. "You could kiss my big black butt." He didn't mean it. That's what I wanted to shout out, but I couldn't make a sound. Mouse pushed against the big man's chest, not to move Bruno, but to push himself far enough away so that he could get out his long .41 caliber pistol. Bruno's manly sneer turned into an 8-year-old's wonder at what he'd done wrong. The impact of the first shot knocked him 4 feet backwards, big hands thrust out in front of him like a cartoon sleepwalker. He wanted to fall, to get down on the ground out of harm's way, but Mouse just kept on shooting, throwing Bruno up against the pork butcher's back door again and again. There was a scream, and I was stumbling backwards into the doorway.
Mouse is in jail as the novel opens, and when he gets out, he's looking for revenge against the man who turned him in for this murder. He's so different from E.Z. Rawlins. E.Z. Rawlins just doesn't have the temperament to rough people up. He can't rough people up to get information out of them. He's not that kind of guy. But do you know men like Mouse?
Oh, yeah. I made spouts on a friend of my father's, a man who used to hijack liquor trucks and bring cases of liquor to our house when I was a kid. And he would come over and he'd say, "Well, Roy," my father, he'd say, "Roy, why don't you keep these bottles of liquor for a week and I'll come back and get them later." And so when he would come back, of course, my father would have drunk a couple of bottles. And so the guy would say, "Well, you're going to have to pay me for those bottles now." Finally, he was in a crap game in a barbershop in downtown L.A., and he murdered a guy. He killed a guy. The guy owed him a dime, and he didn't want to pay it. So he killed him. He's in jail now.
Well, did you grow up thinking, how can a guy kill somebody over a dime?
Well, actually, I understood that. You know, the whole issue, I think, about worrying about, it's not worth it to kill somebody over a dime. We wonder, well, is it worth it to kill somebody over $1 million?
Right.
You know, the issue is different. You know, if you don't have a dime, or if you come from a place where you have to fight for everything that you have, then you just fight. It's a natural reflex, because when you stop fighting, that's when you're going to lose.
So do you feel you understand why an insult can be cause enough that can incite somebody to a murder?
Well, certainly, if you're living in a neighborhood where, you know, your rep is the only thing that you have, and if people can feel that they can insult you and push you around, well, then you're going to lose everything that you have in your life. And so you have to fight for things that seem ridiculous from an external point of view, but internally they make more sense.
So when this guy insults Mouse, Easy wants to say, hey, he didn't mean it, he didn't mean it, back off. But Mouse just kind of plugs him. What's your reaction to an insult when it comes your way?
Well, you know, I have, like Easy has, been able to move a little away from that place where I'm willing to fight at any moment. So if somebody insults me, it doesn't matter. If I'm walking down the street and I have $10 in my pocket and somebody wants to mug me, I'll give them the $10. I'll say, here's the $10. It's not worth, you know, it's not even worth me fighting, even if I could beat you. It's not worth it. I might hurt my fist. But if $10 is all you have, see, I had like maybe $100 in the bank, so that $10 doesn't matter to me right now. But the life that Mouse was living and the life that Easy is very close to is a thing where you have to fight over everything. And so you stop discriminating between when you fight and when you don't fight. You just are always willing to fight. So Mouse, when he comes out of prison, there were three men in the bar. One of them turned him in, he thinks. So he's going to kill all three. That's just the way he does it, because that's the way he's going to keep his reputation up.
You have an opening quote before the book begins, Ghetto Pedagogy. Can I ask you to read it and tell us where this comes from?
This is a conversation I had with my father when I was a little boy. Ghetto Pedagogy. Dad? Yes. Why do black men always kill each other? Long pause. Practicing. I kind of like that. No, I was about 8 or 9, and my father had this, and I had this conversation.
So when your father said practice, what did that mean to you?
Well, that there was a lot of anger and rage in the black community, and it was aimed at people outside of the community, which people really couldn't exercise that rage on at that time. But they still had to exercise it, and so it was on each other. But it was, in a way, getting ready for something. Something that might not ever happen, but certainly it's getting ready for something.
Were you exposed to a lot of violence when you were growing up?
There was a lot of violence in the life. I don't think there's as much violence when I was a child as there is now. However, there was a lot of violence just in everyday life, just in the experience of everyday life. A lot of violence, a lot of anger, a lot of rage, a lot of despair. You know, I react more to psychological violence than physical violence. Physical violence is kind of easy to avoid or stay away from. But there's a kind of psychological violence in everyday life that black people and poor people in general experience in America.
What kind of psychological violence were you most exposed to growing up?
Well, just anger. You know, people who were angry all the time, people who were upset all the time, people who felt that other people were trying to take advantage of them, and sometimes they were right and sometimes they were wrong. Confrontations about everything, about how much something cost, about where you're going to go. I remember coming out of a restaurant with my father when I was, and my mother, when I was about, 12, and there was a valet parking, and so my father comes out and he gives the guy his ticket, and then another guy comes out after us, a white guy, and he gives the guy the ticket, and the guy goes directly to get the white guy's car and brings it back, and you know they get in, and my father goes up to the valet and he says, well, listen, you know, I want you to understand, in a very loud voice, I'm not going to give you a tip, and I'm not giving you a tip because you went and got that man's car before you got my car, but I was first. Now, I was, you know, 12. I was very embarrassed by this whole thing. But there, my father was angry. He needed to express that. So he needed to talk about what was happening to him. And I think that went on an awful lot when I was a child.
Do you think he was right in doing that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No question about it.
Is it hard growing up with so much anger and seeing all these slights all around you and not grow up with a personality that's obsessed with victimization?
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing because even when before you get to the point of whether or not you're a victim, you have to wonder, because people become so sensitive to these slights,
mm-hmm.
that sometimes there aren't slights. One of the things that Easy experiences in the books is that sometimes he's expecting a slight and it doesn't happen. And sometimes when he least suspects it, it does happen. And sometimes it's not from white people, it's from black people. It's very hard to figure out where you stand in the world. And you know, it's hard not to feel you're a victim, especially when you are in certain ways. But then you have to begin to understand that we're all victims and that your job is to live your life and to survive, not to, you know, to worry about what somebody next to you has or doesn't have or what they're thinking.
Now, your father grew up in the South, And, you know, you're writing crime novels. There is violence in your books. Did your father tell you stories about the violence he was exposed to growing up in the segregated South?
One day, you know, it's hard to talk about the segregated South because it, even though that really is a definition of what went on with my father, it's broader than that in experience. One day my father sat me down and explained to me, or told me, every person he'd ever seen die. It was just amazing. Little children killing each other, black children, black people killing white people killing black people killing, you know, everybody killing each other, people being hung, people dying because there was not a proper protection on their jobs. And then he went to World War II. And he talked about all the people that he saw die in World War II because he worked in statistics, so he typed up the names of everybody, all the Americans who had died. And finally, he came back to the South after that, and he found that all of his old friends, or most of his old friends who didn't go to war, had died also in, you know, these kind of petty and stupid little fights and arguments and from disease in the South. And so he moved to Los Angeles. And when my father, this took a long time to tell me all of these deaths. And at the end of it, he said, "So then, Walter, I came to L.A., and I knew I was finally free. I was in a land where these kind of things weren't going to happen anymore." And he sits down in a diner, and the guy next to him has a heart attack, keels over and falls in my father's lap.
Oh, no.
And dies. And it was a good way to end it, because it was a funny story. But also the idea of, you know, there's segregation, there's violence because of racism and from ignorance and poverty, but also we all die. And I think that's what he was trying to tell me.
Writer Walter Mosley is my guest. We'll be back after this break. This is Fresh Air. Walter Mosley is my guest, and his new novel in the E.Z. Rollins series is called Black Betty. The novels are set in L.A., and you're right. You could tell by some people's houses that they came to L.A. to live out their dreams. Home is not a place to dream. At home, you had to do like your father did and your mother. Did both your parents move to... I know your father moved to L.A. from the South. What about your mother?
My mother moved from New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And she was... my mother's Jewish, comes from, you know, from Eastern European stock. And her father was a doctor and a very kind of dominant, I think, in a lot of ways. And she needed to get away from him and that family. And my father needed to get away from Jim Crow. So they were people looking for new lives, new ways. And you notice it in L.A. Everybody's looking for a new life and hoping that everything will open up for them and everything will change for them in Southern California.
Yeah, your mother is white and Jewish. Your father was black. I know some white people who have married black people have been in the absurd situation of finding that their families have disowned them for marrying a black person.
And black people, too.
And black people disown their person for marrying a white person. Did anything like that happen on either side of the family?
Well, you know, it's interesting. It did to some degree. And it was very funny. The matriarch of my father's side of the family liked my mother, so she could never be completely ostracized. So she got along with her, invite her over, and would do things. And some of the family didn't like her, and that kind of wore off after a while, and they got along. And on my mother's side of the family, my grandfather just didn't understand. Even though he was a doctor, he didn't really think that black people and white people were the same, like, species. Not only not the same race, but the same species. But a very funny thing happened. He came to visit once to see his grandson, because, you know, my mother demanded it and came out. And he was kind of taciturn. And he went away. And then my father built a house in the backyard, built a whole house. He floored it, walled it, plumbed it, wired it, did everything. And my grandfather came back and he saw this house. And then he saw that my father had built it. And so in a funny way, my father kind of proved that he was better than my grandfather, because my grandfather would love to do something like that and couldn't. And so then after that, my grandfather really liked him. It was a very kind of country thing, you know, because my grandfather was from he was from a rural background too. So my father in some way proved to him that he wasn't inferior. It was funny. Then they got along great after that.
So on the whole, did both families get along?
Oh, yeah. They got along great. When I was 13, I had a big party. I couldn't have a bar mitzvah, so I had a big party. And we invited both sides of the family over, you know, my Aunt Fanny and my Uncle Chaim and my godfather, Hollister P. Fontenot, and the Douglas family. And Hollister, who was 6'5" and the jokester on my father's side of the family, and Chaim, who was only 4'9" and the jokester on the other side, would stand in a corner telling each other jokes. It was wonderful.
That sounds great.
Yeah. By the way, all this conflict I was unaware of. Nobody in the family ever said it to me.
So how'd you find out?
When I was 30 or 35, I was talking to my mother about it, and she told me.
Now, your first book wasn't a detective novel.
Gone Fishing was a book about Easy and Mouse, but it was in the 30s. They were in their late teens. Easy was, start showing his kind of existentialist side, wondering about what's right and wrong and what he should do in the world, and even finding out that maybe he should learn how to read. Mouse was beginning to be a sociopath, has decided because he's going to get married that he should either murder or humiliate his stepfather. And it's how they both go out on this road looking for fathers in very different ways that the novel was based.
Now that you've been writing a whole detective series, I wonder what you really love about having a series, and if there's anything about it that makes you feel a little bit trapped.
Well, I like this. Even when I wrote that first book, Gone Fishing, I thought I would like to write a series of books about this character, mm-hmm, Easy, mm-hmm, and follow him from the Deep South to California and the various things that he would have done there. I'm lucky in as much as that Norton is my publisher, W.W. Norton, because they don't publish mysteries. You see, the problem is if you're with a publisher that publishes mysteries, then they don't want you to do different things. Norton really doesn't mind so much. Then my next book is going to be called R.L.'s Dream, and it's a novel about a man who once played music with Robert Johnson, and this man is now dying in New York in the 80s. And it's him remembering Robert Johnson and remembering his life. So it's a novel about the blues.
Now, what interests you about Robert Johnson, the kind of great blues guitarist and singer whose work is so underdocumented? I mean, we have a few of his sides. We have like one or two photographs of him.
Right.
And everybody projects so much onto Robert Johnson because there's so little evidence of who he really was.
Well, I'm interested in him in the same way that I'm interested in the blues. I think that the blues is the dominant form of real drama in the 20th century, meaning to say that it is tragedy. It's like kind of a crystallized form of tragedy where, you know, it talks about loss and it talks about sadness in the same way that somebody like Christopher Marlowe was doing it, you know, centuries ago. Now, Marlowe, I think, is very close to Johnson because they both came into a form which they kind of rediscovered and raised to a level of greatness. They were both very sexually active. They were both murdered in bars in their 20s. And so I see Robert Johnson as the ideal of the blues, a man who takes a form and raises it to a level of genius.
Now, Easy Rollins is going to be in a movie now.
Oh, yeah.
Jonathan Demme's filming your first book?
Jonathan Demme is the executive producer. The director is Carl Franklin, who did the movie One False Move.
Great.
The star is Denzel Washington. Jennifer Beals is starring with him. And the DP is Tak Fujimoto, which I'm also very excited about because he's a great DP.
Now, what's your role in the making of the movie? Do you have any?
It's an informal role. I mean,
advisor.
Consultant.
They
have me like associate producer. Carl Franklin, who wrote the screenplay also, talked to me about it a lot. Even recently, he had to change a name in the movie for certain reasons. So he called me up and he said, well, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? And I always agree. I say, yeah, that sounds good. And they would do it. My role in it is just kind of enjoying it, really.
Is it enjoyable?
I've been having a great time. You know, I know a lot of people have bad times with books and movies and stuff, but everybody's really committed to the book and what the book did, and they're trying to recreate it in this movie, you know, which is a difficult thing to do. And I think that they're doing it, and I'm very pleased.
So once the movie's made, when you write more about Easy Rollins, will you see Denzel in your mind?
I don't think so. I don't see Easy. It's a very funny thing. When I'm writing these books, they're first-person books, I write them from Easy's point of view. There are very few people who run around thinking about what they look like.
Right.
You know, what they do is they feel worried more about what they think. And so when you go through the books, there's only a few things. I think at one point, you know that Easy has a hairy chest, and you know he's a little bit over 6'1", and he's strong, but not the strongest person in the world. And that's really all you know. You don't know what his face looks like, because who talks about it? I've never talked about what my face looks like. And so I'm not really concerned that I'm going to worry about, you know, him looking like Denzel.
Are you writing your own film, too?
I'm working on a movie now, actually, a more contemporary film about a young black man who's homeless and living and kind of on the the fringe of the drug world, living in Harlem, and how he tries to make a decision to make his life work right, and what happens from that moment.
Is this the first thing that you're writing that's actually set in the present?
God, that's a good question. No, but the first thing that's coming close to getting into the public.
Huh. So what's the difference for you, writing about the present instead of the past?
Well, you know, there's no difference. To begin with, 1948, which is my earliest book that's been published, is not the past to me. It's so recent, it's like now. So it's hard for me to think that I'm writing books. I mean, people tell me I'm writing period pieces. It's funny, but I don't really think of it like that. I think of the past, you know, as being maybe the 14th century. And I guess that's something I'd have to research and worry about. But the language of black people, for instance, hasn't changed a whole lot since the 40s. The problems that people face in urban situations hasn't changed hardly at all since the 40s. So the life is really very similar.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm asking you this because place is so important in your fiction. You live in Greenwich Village in New York City now?
Right.
How did you choose that as the place to live?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There's a lot of reasons, kind of social reasons. One, it's a pretty safe place to live. It's nice. It's easy. Mm-hmm. A lot of different kinds of people live there. Racially, a lot of different kinds, you know, Asians, Hispanics, blacks, whites, straight people, gay people. But also, the classes live together. One of the wonderful things about Manhattan that's different than L.A. and a lot of other places in the country is that they're not really separated by class so much. So you could have somebody who's living in a rent-controlled apartment, an old Italian lady, maybe 90 years old, living in a rent-controlled apartment, and next door, Charles Kuralt lives, you know, and down the street, Roy Lichtenstein lives. And that's, I like that. I feel that I'm not kind of caught in any kind of particular way of being.
I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, thank you. This has been fun.
Walter Mosley, his new novel is called Black Betty. I'm Jerry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.